88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to look back at an Annapolis radio station that broadcast music primarily catered to an African-American audience for 50 years, from 1947 to 1997. Ephemera and objects from the station, called WANN, are on display at the Smithsonian Museum of American History, which has a permanent exhibit that opened in July called American Enterprise. The exhibit traces America's development from a small, agriculturally dependent country to a global economic powerhouse. It's an eclectic collection. They have things like an early Monopoly board game and the name tag of a shoe clerk who worked at the department store Woodward and Lothrop. And to highlight the African-American experience from the consumer era, which is what the Smithsonian is calling the 1940s through the 1970s, they selected artifacts from WANN. Larry Blum is the son of the founder and owner of WANN, Morris Blum. He joins us on the phone from Glen Burnie, and joining us from Williamsburg, Virginia, is Dr. Charlie McGovern. He's the program director and director of undergraduate studies and associate professor of American studies and history at the College of William and Mary. Dr. Blum and Dr. McGovern, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Much thanks.
Dr. Blum, let me start with you. Tell us how the station got its start. I guess your dad started it when he returned from World War II?
Yes. He'd been a communications officer with the United States Navy during the war, and his career goals after the war were to begin a radio station. He looked at various cities near his hometown of Baltimore, and he started a radio station in Annapolis, which was one of the few state capitals at that time that did not have a local radio station. Very quickly, the city had three radio stations. At that point, my father had a decision to make about the economic viability of a radio station facing a lot of competition in a small town. And that's where the idea of catering to an African-American audience slowly began to take hold.
And how did it start? What was the program format before he switched to that format?
It would have been general and basic radio. This was a radio station that got started before television. My father had employed at the end of the broadcast day, a disc jockey to play some records at the very last hour of the day from the local College of St. John's College. And my father had a collection of records in the back of the radio station then that his manager had advised him not to play. This was so-called race music in that time. And the manager had gone off on vacation, and my father gave the DJ the records to play for the last hour of the day. Usually fan mail had been minimal. All of a sudden, within a week of putting the show on, the mailbox burst open when he opened it at the post office, with fan mail coming out from all over the Chesapeake Bay region, from Baltimore, southern counties, eastern shore. So clearly my father realized there is an audience that wants to be entertained.
Yeah, the market proved itself. And Dr. Charlie McGovern, obviously Annapolis was segregated, Maryland and the country was segregated in the 1940s and the 1950s, but I guess the airwaves weren't. How did that work in terms of crossover between a white and a black audience?
The airwaves weren't segregated in the sense that you could turn the dial, but the stations that catered to African-American sounds were located all the way at one end or the other of the dial, the lower frequencies. In any city you went to in the 1950s, you could in effect find black voices and black music literally by spinning the dial all the way to one end or another. In that sense, people knew where to find those voices and that music. It was a lot easier to hear black music and for African Americans to hear the voices of their community speaking to them about their interests than it was for African Americans and whites to associate socially. And of course, there were many prohibitions in the North as well as the South.
Did stations like WANN, both here and around the country, did they have many white listeners?
One of the reasons that most stations began to cater to African American listeners was because they saw that market as untapped and, of course, very likely to be loyal, especially if the stations played the music that the people wanted to hear and had personalities who addressed them in ways that they wished to be addressed and spoke to their concerns. But increasingly over time, white Americans picked up on the music, especially. It wasn't surprising that most of these were young people, because that music became, of course, the roots of what eventually we came to know as rock and roll. So there was a sense of attraction for a lot of young people. This music was different. It was exciting. It had a vibrancy that sometimes was missing from the general pop music of the day.
And Dr. Blum, I want to talk about a particular personality who was on WANN. This is Hoppy Adams. He was a DJ there for many years, and during the summers he used to broadcast shows from a place called Cars Beach. Tell us that story.
Hoppy Adams had been hired by my father at first as a part-time disc jockey and then later full-time. He actually had worked in other radio stations briefly before coming to work for my father. He already had been a bit of a local personality. He came from a very prominent African-American family in Annapolis, and he was an athlete, though impaired by polio. His gait was impaired, but he was an excellent swimmer, thus the name Hoppy. Cars Beach was a segregated beach near Bay Ridge, Annapolis. The beaches, of course, in that era were completely segregated. There were two African-American beaches that catered to African-American audiences and patrons on weekends. One was considered, quote, the family entertainment beach, unquote. That was Sparrows Beach. Cars Beach had acts that were more secular in nature and was open to African-Americans, though whites were and other races were certainly allowed to attend if they wanted to.
We have a clip from Hoppy Adams broadcasting on WANN.
Billy, how would you like to see all the top recording stars this summer? Well, you can at Cars Beach in Annapolis. This season will be jammed.
Dr. Blum, you went on to a career as a medical neurologist. When you were a kid, did you have a personal recollection of meeting Hoppy Adams? What kind of guy was he?
Well, quite well. I worked at the radio station as a teenager and young adult, but I actually worked in the radio station as a news person, broadcasting news for Hoppy, doing the engineering, answering the doors, helping him get his records ready. So in the summer times, I did all of that for him. He was very charismatic, particularly on the air. He had a lot of presence and a lot of dignity.
Dr. McGovern, the exhibit at the Smithsonian breaks this notion of the American enterprise into these broad chunks of time. They call one the merchant era, the corporate era. They talk about the consumer era, which they basically date from the 40s to the 70s. What does that entail? What does that mean?
The American economy emerged after World War II as dominant in no small part because it was the last one standing, so to speak. It had not experienced the same kind of devastation that most of the other powers in the war had done. And also, the economy was what some scholars have called Fordism. It was based on mass production and mass distribution. And things were geared toward the assumption that if you made good quality products at a low enough price, you could sell many of them. And thus the working class who made the products could also afford to buy them. And that was the formula that carried American business through the middle decades of the century, eventually replaced more and more by what we might think of as niche marketing rather than trying to reach everyone with the same product to really peg things to different economic levels and to different, if you will, cultural position. But from the 40s to the 70s, the United States economy was dominant because they had an equitable distribution of income, much more so than now, and because they were able to produce products at prices that working class wage workers were able to afford.
And Dr. Blum, we have a picture of a flyer that WANN Radio distributed to potential advertisers talking about the fact that its African-American audience was the largest outside of New York. Your dad was white, you know, you're white. Growing up, did you get a sense that it was unusual for a white man to own a radio station that catered to the black market?
Well, initially, no. When you're a small child, you sort of take it in stride. You figure this is one part of the world. I can say that thanks to the experience of having been part of WANN, I wasn't exposed in the context of work and family to some of the issues that were going on in society. I didn't see some of the tensions that were going on. As I got older, I began to realize not everybody enjoyed what we were doing. Not everybody approved. There were a lot of people that would make disparaging remarks or who would keep their distance from our experience. At times, extremely cold, to say the least, as to the reception Annapolis gave my father and gave the radio station. So in a sense, we were living in our own world.
Please don't go. Or never leave me, baby. Please don't go.
Was it financially viable? Was it successful?
I'd say that in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, we were doing very well. By the early 80s, not as well. All pioneers, whatever they may be a pioneer in, find that at some point they're beginning to get a bit outmoded. Also, radio was changing. There was a lot more competition. Deregulation in the early 80s allowed for radio stations to pop up all over the dial, both in the AM and FM frequency. FM began to become more dominant.
Yeah, so there are a lot of other market forces right. affecting this, yeah. And Dr. McGovern, is WANN unusual? Is it unique?
It was not unusual at all for African-American-oriented radio stations to be owned by whites. In fact, when Mr. Blum started WANN, there was only one radio station owned by an African-American, and that was in WERD in Atlanta. By the end of the 1950s, there were only three stations owned by African-American. So the control of these businesses was in the hands of whites. That said, it was possible by the early 1960s to drive across the country through a southern route, if you would, and hear black people on the air all the time you were driving, if you basically drove during the day. That's how many stations were catering to African-American audiences. There were many, many stations that devoted some substantial portion of their airtime to having African-American voices on the air and broadcasting black music, essentially for black people.
And talk about this notion of race music and the crossover that eventually occurred. I mean, it's famously remembered by about Sam Phillips, the guy that discovered Elvis Presley, that he was specifically looking for a white singer who sounded black. And of course, you alluded to earlier the influence of so-called race music, black music, on what became American rock and roll. Where does that stand in this arc of history?
The same kind of Jim Crow that was in American society was also being used to categorize American music, even though we had and have plenty of evidence that African Americans and whites listened to one another, shared and stole traditions from one another. And again, of course, African Americans had much less power in this. Even though the music was mixed, the categories were separated. The idea that something was made by an African-American meant that it was largely geared to African-Americans. There were, of course, many important exceptions, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, among them. So race music was a slightly derogatory term that increasingly became more and more derogatory as African-Americans' freedom struggle grew in the 1940s. By the end of the 1940s, black performers like Lionel Hampton were rebelling against that term. They just wanted their music to be known as music and not have any race label attached to it. But that music was still largely segregated from white ears. You might hear Ellington or Lionel Hampton on a pop station, but you wouldn't hear H-Bomb Ferguson you wouldn't necessarily hear the Orioles out of Baltimore. That was music that was still geared toward African Americans. And it was the radio stations that broke that barrier down, because they didn't attract white listeners. And eventually the people who made the records realized that there was a broader audience for it. It was very much true that as white musicians openly acknowledged their debts to African American sounds and traditions, they drew a broader audience in for their music. And that's really how the barriers began to break down. A lot of it was commerce. You know, it wasn't about civil rights per se. But the market, in that sense, is very important. People will sometimes chase green where they will not necessarily be comfortable with mixing black and white.
Dr. Larry Blum is the son of the founder and owner of WANN Radio, Morris Blum. Dr. Charlie McGovern is professor of American Studies and History at the College of William and Mary. We've got more information and more of our conversation on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, ahead Ensemble Galilei. But first, here's a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.